This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. U.S. President Joe Biden says there's a high risk that Russia will soon invade Ukraine. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
Every indication we have is they're prepared to go into Ukraine.
Saying the U.S. sees no signs of a promised Russian troop withdrawal from the Ukraine border. At the U.N. Security Council, Secretary of State Antony Blinken detailed how the U.S. thinks an invasion would start, with Russia creating an event as justification and then launching bombs and missiles.
Russian tanks and soldiers will advance on key targets that have already been identified.
Blinken says he's revealing intelligence conclusions in hopes of preempting an assault, but gave little evidence. Russia continues denying it plans to invade. At the same time, it has expelled America's number two diplomat from the Moscow embassy. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
The crisis in Ukraine has united most Republicans and Democrats in a rare moment. A bipartisan agreement that the United States must stand strong against the aggression of Russian President Vladimir Putin. But a small group within the Republican Party, heavily influenced by former President Donald Trump's stance toward Russia, has criticized President Biden for opposing Putin's designs on Ukraine. Some go as far as to say Russia has a right to invade. Meanwhile, some progressive Democrats in the House of Representatives have warned that there is no military solution to the crisis. Recent polling shows a slight majority of Americans support the U.S. staying out of negotiations to end the crisis. You can keep up on all of our coverage of the Ukraine crisis at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Iran's supreme leader vowed on Thursday that his country would ramp up development of its civilian nuclear program as major world powers continued talks in Vienna to revive Tehran's landmark nuclear deal. In a televised speech on Thursday, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei urged the importance of nuclear energy for Iran, while again asserting that it had no interest in nuclear weapons. The accord, which former President Donald Trump abandoned nearly 4 years ago, granted Iran sanctions relief in exchange for curbs on its nuclear program. Iran's chief nuclear negotiator tweeted late on Wednesday that the parties were, quote, closer than ever to an agreement. But talks have repeatedly stalled in recent months as Iranian negotiators press hardline demands. Khamenei has stayed largely silent on the ongoing negotiations, but he has called claims that Iran was pursuing a bomb nonsense, saying they were meant to deprive Iran of its legitimate right to nuclear power. Authorities in Sydney, Australia, reopened several beaches Friday, a day after the first fatal shark attack in the area since 1963. A video shared online showed a shark attacking a swimmer Wednesday off Little Bay Beach, about 20 kilometers south of Sydney, Australia's largest city. Officials said they believed a great white shark, at least 3 meters in length, was responsible for the attack. Baited lines and drones were being used to try and track and catch the shark involved in Wednesday's attack. A local official said beaches were allowed to reopen when no sharks had been seen in the area. The victim of the attack was identified as a male 35-year-old diving instructor who had moved to Australia about 6 years ago. Niger's defense ministry said Thursday that an improvised explosive device killed 5 Nigerian soldiers a day earlier in the country's southwest. The ministry said in a statement read on public radio that an army patrol unit on Wednesday hit the device, killing the 5 soldiers and wounding 2 others. The blast occurred in the Tillaberi region, a flashpoint zone where the frontiers of Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali converge. Western Niger has for years faced jihadist attacks, despite the efforts of international forces to fight the Islamist insurgents. Rescue workers and city officials in the Brazilian mountain city of Petropolis say the death toll has risen to at least 104, including at least 13 children, from landslides driven by torrential rain. On Tuesday, the search for survivors continues. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Friday, February 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adolfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, a top U.S. diplomat lays out how Russia could decide to invade Ukraine despite the diplomatic push to avert war.
Russia plans to manufacture a pretext for its attack. This could be a violent event that Russia will blame on Ukraine, or an outrageous accusation that Russia will level against the Ukrainian government.
U.S. lawmakers struggle to agree on punitive sanctions to deter Russian invasion of Ukraine.
U.S. senators united in supporting Ukraine against Russian aggression. But the effort to deliver legislation sanctioning Russian President Vladimir Putin remains stalled.
And a judge rules former President Donald Trump must answer questions under oath into his business practices. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken laid out at the United Nations Security Council on Thursday how Washington believes Russia could seek to invade Ukraine, warning that Moscow was preparing to take such action in the, quote, coming days, unquote. Blinken accused Moscow of planning to manufacture a pretext for an attack on Ukraine that could include what he called, quote, a fake, even a real attack using chemical weapons, unquote. Blinken made an appearance at a meeting of the 15-member Council of the Minsk Agreements, which aimed to end an 8-year-long conflict between Ukrainian army and Russian-backed separatists in the east of the country. Speaking before Blinken, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Vashinin appealed to Council members not to turn the meeting into, his words, quote, a circus, unquote, by presenting, quote, a baseless accusation that Russia allegedly was going to attack Ukraine, unquote. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken.
Over the past months, without provocation or justification, Russia has amassed more than 150,000 troops around Ukraine's borders in Russia, Belarus, occupied Crimea. Russia says it's drawing down those forces. We do not see that happening on the ground. Our information indicates clearly that these forces, including ground troops, aircraft, ships, are preparing to launch an attack against Ukraine in the coming days. We don't know precisely how things will play out, but here's what the world can expect to see unfold. In fact, it's unfolding right now, today, as Russia takes steps down the path to war and reissued the threat of military action. First, Russia plans to manufacture a pretext for its attack. This could be a violent event that Russia will blame on Ukraine, or an outrageous accusation that Russia will level against the Ukrainian government. We don't know exactly the form it will take. It could be a fabricated so-called terrorist bombing inside Russia, the invented discovery of a mass grave, a staged drone strike against civilians, or a fake, even a real, attack using chemical weapons. So let me make this simple. The Russian government can announce today, with no qualification, equivocation, or deflection, that Russia will not invade Ukraine. State it clearly, state it plainly to the world, and then demonstrate it by sending your troops, your tanks, your planes, back to their barracks and hangars, and sending your diplomats to the negotiating table.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. As diplomatic efforts intensify to avert war in Europe, I spoke with VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir on reactions to U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's evidence of Russia's continuing plans to invade Ukraine.
We didn't really hear in the council reactions per se to what he said, but I think the general feeling we heard from every single council member was it's time for de-escalation and diplomacy, and this is the only route that we can go in settling this crisis.
Did Russia provide any further evidence that they're actually withdrawing? Because they provided some videos that NATO and the Secretary of State countered by saying they're actually putting more men.
Well, they're just very, you know, dismissive of everyone who says they're doing anything negative, basically. The Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Vershinin chaired today's meeting because Russia is actually the president of the Security Council for the month of February. It's a rotating position that each council member gets a chance to do throughout the course of the year. And this month is Russia's, coincidentally, Russia's turn, goes in alphabetical order. So he just said, basically, we've long ago clarified and explained everything, and any attempts to blame Russia are futile and baseless. And he said, don't turn this meeting into a circus where you're going to accuse us of things. So he just sort of brushed it all off. And he wanted to make the meeting more about things like the Minsk Agreement, which are a series of steps to resolve the crisis. And these were written Biden in 2015 after Russia annexed Crimea in 2014. So they were really trying to focus, the Russians were trying to focus on Minsk and blaming the Ukrainians for not upholding their end of the agreement. But it can be said that everyone is also pointing the finger at Russia saying they're not upholding it either. So they really need to kind of revive this agreement.
What next? Is there anything else planned? Efforts continue to diplomatically try to stop this from turning into a shooting war.
Well, I think the UN's role in this is very limited because Russia is a principal in the Security Council. They have a veto power. It's not like the Security Council could adopt some resolution or impose some sanctions or something because Russia would veto it. So that leaves the Secretary General, who spoke this week saying there's no alternative to diplomacy, but he's really not a big player in this scenario, let's be honest. This is about the Western capitals. The action is taking place in the Western capitals and in Moscow, and it's going to be resolved among the big players. And we see several countries are meeting in Germany this week for the annual Munich Security Conference, so that gives leaders an opportunity to talk to each other about the situation. There's been a flurry of diplomatic activity. We saw President Macron and Chancellor Scholz and all these various European leaders going to Moscow and such. So there's been a lot of activity, and I think we're going to see that continue.
That's VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with me from New York. U.S. lawmakers struggled to agree this week on a package of punitive sanctions to deter Russian President Vladimir Putin from a possible invasion of Ukraine. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports that despite the stalled effort, there is still pressure on Capitol Hill to mount a unified U.S. response to Russia.
U.S. senators united in supporting Ukraine against Russian aggression. But the effort to deliver legislation sanctioning Russian President Vladimir Putin for a possible invasion of Ukraine remains stalled, a source of frustration on Capitol Hill. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
Sanctions bill has gotten bogged down into a fundamental difference. Generally, the Democrats think you should do a sanctions bill announcing in advance what you would do if there was an invasion, and Republican position has been sanctions should be imposed immediately.
A former Trump administration official told lawmakers Wednesday that the U.S. approach to sanctions is constrained by European allies. Former acting director of national intelligence Richard Grenell.
Joe Biden and the Biden administration have decided that we have to act in concert with the Europeans on this, and therefore the Germans are really watering down our response.
That's left many congressional Republicans warning that the opportunity to deter Putin may have already passed. Republican Senator Mike Rounds.
I believe that we're way too late now. I think we have to be in a position to make sure that Mr. Putin understands that should he invade, that there will be severe consequences, not just for the people of Russia, but really on the people that support him.
Republicans have criticized President Biden for being slow to respond to the crisis. But there's also a sense on Capitol Hill that the U.S. must present a united front to Russia. Sanctions under consideration include imposing severe limits on Russian banking, cutting off the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany, and increasing military aid to Ukraine. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal.
We need to show resolve as well as resilience, come together on a package that shows Putin that we are united across the aisle and that there's bipartisan support for deterrence. That we mean business, that there will be crippling economic sanctions, as well as continued arms aid to Ukraine, no American troops on the ground. But Vladimir Putin seems to be getting that message, and we should in no way relent at this point on a strategy that seems to be working.
President Biden's speech on Ukraine Tuesday was welcomed on both sides of the aisle, as lawmakers said there were still options beyond a sanctions package. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
I'm hopeful that President Biden will rise to the occasion. As a bipartisan group of colleagues and I made clear in a joint statement yesterday, the president would have overwhelming bipartisan support to use his existing executive authorities for tough sanctions against Russia in the event of conflict.
Executive action may be the most immediate option for the U.S. response, since the U.S. Senate has just 2 days left in session this month. Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. and China continue to spar on freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, with Beijing claiming much of the islands and waters in the area as its own. One major regional power has been mostly quiet on the dispute so far, but that may be changing. VOA's Eunice Salim filed this report narrated by Nova Powadi.
Southeast Asia's largest nation, Indonesia, has often taken a soft approach to China's territorial claims in the South China Sea, but Indonesia has recently begun asserting its rights in the region. It has been drilling in offshore waters China considers disputed, and joint military exercises with U.S. forces in August prompted a letter of protest from Beijing leaders. The Tuna Block is part of the waters off Natuna Islands, which have become a relatively recent flashpoint. Indonesia considers it part of its exclusive economic zone, while Beijing considers the region part of their traditional fishing waters. Like many nations in the Indo-Pacific, Indonesia now finds itself regularly fending off Chinese fishing fleets and coast guard in the disputed waters. Faced with these continuing challenges from China, Indonesia is now reaching out to five fellow members of the regional grouping ASEAN, or the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, and Vietnam, to coordinate their coast guards in the face of Chinese encroachment. But in pursuing a tougher line against China's territorial ambitions off Natuna, Indonesia risks alienating its largest trading partner and second-largest source of foreign investment. It's a similar balancing act for the five countries seeking greater cooperation with Indonesia on maritime security, as well as for Indo-Pacific nations in general. A meeting of coast guards from six affected ASEAN members was scheduled for February, but has been postponed till at least March, reportedly due to COVID. For Eunice Salim, Nova Purwadi, VOA News.
In other news, a judge has ruled that former President Donald Trump must answer questions under oath in a New York investigation into his business practices. State Judge Arthur Engoron made a decision Thursday. It is likely to be appealed. New York Attorney General Letitia James' office issued subpoenas in December to Trump and his two eldest children, Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. Both of them have been executives in their family's Trump organization. They were also ordered to testify. The judge previously sided with James on other matters relating to the probe, including making Eric Trump testify after his lawyers abruptly canceled a scheduled deposition. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Hundreds of truckers clogging the streets of Canada's capital stood their ground and defiantly blasted their horns Thursday as police poured in, threatening to break up the nearly three-week protest against the country's COVID-19 restrictions. Busloads of police officers arrived near Ottawa's Parliament Hill, and workers put up extra fences around government buildings. Many of the truckers in the self-styled Freedom Convoy appeared unmoved by days of warnings from police and the government that they were risking arrests and could see their rigs seized and bank accounts frozen. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau told Parliament Thursday morning that it's time for the illegal and dangerous activities to stop. What are the economic consequences of the blockade on the U.S. and surrounding regions? Joseph Gagnon is senior fellow at Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says economic disruptions are minimal, but could worsen if the protests continue.
So the truck blockade interrupted about $300 million a day in trade on that one main bridge in Ontario. And there were some other border crossings affected. It's not clear how much trade was lost in total because some of it may have been rerouted and some of it may be catch-ups. Maybe they can, you know, catch up from some of the lost trade. So it's really hard to know. Effect on the U.S. economy is anywhere from just above zero to maybe $2 or $3 billion, which is a lot of money for a six-day protest. But it's a pretty small amount relative to the size of the U.S. economy. economy. And I don't think we'll see it really visible on the data. Sort of like a winter storm that hits a region, you know, that can reduce economic activity by hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars. But it happens regularly, and it isn't a big deal in the overall data.
Some in the U.S. are already calling for such actions across cities and states. How possible is that? And will that make more impact to families in the United States?
Well, if we have widespread blockades in the United States, similar to what happened in Canada and at the border, that could have a big effect, but it's something that we really have never seen before in this country, and I really don't know how likely it is.
How important are truckers to the overall economy?
Well, truckers are very important to the economy. I mean, there really is no other way to get so many things that we buy to the final destination. Train system is pretty much very overworked these days, so there isn't much excess capacity. We need truckers to go that final mile to stores and houses. But you know, truckers are a huge, varied group. There's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of truckers in this country. They don't all act the same way. It seems unlikely that a huge fraction of them would protest. I would note that the biggest trucking union, the Teamsters Union, opposed the blockades. And so they're not likely to support similar action in the United States.
This started as a protest against COVID-19 mandates, but now it's morphing into something else. How should the government be tackling this, looking at the overall economy?
I'm not aware of how widespread it is. From what I can see, it's not very widespread, so I'm not very worried. But
and how would you describe the U.S. economy now that it appears as if we are just rounding the corner where the pandemic is concerned?
Well, I think there's going to be changes in the way we do work that last a very long time, and most of them are good. I think most employees are happy when given the opportunity to work from home, either in addition to or instead of working at the office. I think that actually can save a lot of wasted time and commutes and a lot of wasted energy on commuting. And also, the new job opportunities are enabling a lot of people to quit their jobs that they don't like and move to jobs that they prefer. So it's really been a boon for workers, especially low-end workers. Minimum wage workers have seen big increases in their wages. It hasn't really affected the middle class yet, and the middle class is hurting from higher inflation. But I think when all is said and done, the economy is very strong, wages are going up, jobs are plentiful. And so I think once we get inflation under control, this should be a very good time to be a worker.
That's Joseph Gagnon, Senior Fellow at Peterson Institute for International Economics, speaking with me from Washington. Finance ministers from the group of 20 industrialized nations began a two-day meeting in Jakarta, Indonesia, Thursday, amid a growing debt crisis. The coronavirus pandemic has seen many poorer countries build up large debts, and campaigners say it is undermining their ability to provide basic services like healthcare and education. In an interview with VOA, the Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development warned that creditor nations must take urgent actions to avoid, quote, a lost decade, unquote, in the developing world. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Sri Lanka's golden beaches normally attract millions of tourists, but that source of income was cut off by the pandemic. Its economy is suffering. Bond ratings have been downgraded, and economists fear it could soon default. It's not alone. The coronavirus pandemic has driven total global debt to its highest level in more than half a century, according to the World Bank. Debt levels were already high, but the pandemic has hit developing nations hard, according to Rebecca Grinspan, Secretary General of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, in an interview with VOA.
You have them building up their debt and their export earnings not being enough to pay for their debt load. So this situation is really dramatic already for many of these countries.
Figures from the International Monetary Fund show Ethiopia, Tunisia, Argentina, El Salvador, Ghana, the Republic of Congo, Tajikistan and Mozambique are also at high risk of default. Lebanon, Suriname, Venezuela and Zambia have already defaulted on their sovereign debt. Many developing nations took out loans during the pandemic. They now face big repayments, estimated by the World Bank at $35 billion in 2022, an increase of 45% on the previous year, with almost half owed to China. Meanwhile, economic growth forecasts have been cut. Again, Rebecca Grinspan.
For the first time, the rate of growth of the developing countries is less than the rate of growth of the developed countries. So in terms of the sustainability of this debt burden, we are in a very high risk space.
The group of 20 leading rich and developing nations froze some debt repayments during the pandemic. Again, Rebecca Grinspan.
It is in the right direction, but it has two problems. One is that it's a suspension. So the countries will have to start paying in June this year, while the crisis is not over. And secondly, that the impact in terms of debt servicing with respect to the total debt servicing of the developing countries is very, very small.
The G20 has also proposed a debt reduction program, but so far only three countries have come forward for help.
Many countries don't want to come in because they will be punished by the markets. And if they are punished by the markets, their access to private bonds and the possibility of to go to the markets to finance themselves will be really hindered.
The warnings of a debt crisis come as borrowing costs rise sharply, with central banks ramping up interest rates to tackle inflation. Grinspan says creditor nations must take urgent action on debt relief and financial aid. The alternative, she warns, is a lost decade for developing countries. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Experts from nine countries are planning to collect and combine aquatic animal sounds for a global library. Scientists in Australia believe an undersea chorus of mammals, fish and some invertebrates will help gauge the health of marine ecosystems. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Songs by bearded seals and the buoying of a minke whale are part of a global collection being put together for the first time by a team of international researchers. The samples are stored in the individual libraries of various institutions, but never before have they been curated in a single collection. All marine mammals are thought to emit sounds, including the humpback whale and many fish and invertebrates. Researchers aim to use the new databank of recordings to measure biodiversity and the health of ecosystems. Miles Parsons, a researcher at the Australian Institute of Marine Science and the lead author of a report on the databank, says animal sounds can indicate the health of an ecosystem.
When you're talking about things like the soundscapes, there's a lot of work recently that's been done to tease out the acoustic characteristics of a soundscape to be able to identify the type of habitat that it is and even start to look at the quality of the habitat. There's been some work recently where they've looked at the difference between degraded coral reefs and healthy coral reefs and the differences in the soundscapes that you have between those. There's lots of different applications that you can get from this, from passive acoustic monitoring.
The mulloway is one of the loudest fish in the world. Of the 34,000 known species of fish, only 1,000 have had their sounds documented. Researchers use highly sophisticated ocean hydrophones or underwater microphones to record sounds. Amateur divers have used underwater cameras to record the squeaks and groans of marine life, and they submit their findings to academics. And some birds reportedly make underwater noises. Scientists believe that pollution and warming temperatures are changing underwater acoustics. The research paper, Sounding the Call for a Global Library of Biological Underwater Sounds, was published in the journal Frontiers in Ecology and Evolution. It's a collaboration between experts from various countries, including Britain, China, New Zealand, and the United States. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website, for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a great weekend.
This is the voice of America, Washington, ba 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 zip.